Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. Although this time, it's two guests at a time. My guests for this episode are Cece and Peter, the brother-sister duo from Sci-Fi Sidebar, and we're going to be discussing Foundation's Edge, which won the 1983 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Cece, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having us, Seth. I'm so excited.
And Peter, thank you as well.
Thank you, Seth.
Yeah, this is another success story of my contact form on the website, because I think, Peter, you filled it out a while back, and we've been going back and forth for quite a while.
Yeah, a while back, like November, but we got there eventually.
We figured it out.
Yes, yeah.
A lot of email tag.
Definitely. Yeah, quite a bit of that. So, but no, I'm delighted to have you guys on. So maybe one of you want to give us kind of the quick 411 on your podcast.
Okay, sure. I'll take care of that. So Sci-Fi Sidebar has been going on for about 16 months or so at this point. We started in January of 2018. And basically, we had both loved talking about sci-fi and kind of discussing books that we both read and sharing books and sharing each our passions for this. And so we kind of wanted to figure out a more solid way to do it so we have something kind of carrying forward. The goal was never really to get like a lot of listeners, just kind of to tie us together. And then if other people enjoyed our conversation like as much as we do, they could tag along too. So Sci-Fi Sidebar, unlike Hugo's There, we do basically any sci-fi that tickles our fancy.
Yes, we definitely have covered a pretty diverse, I would say.
Oh, yes.
Films, yeah. Books, you know.
Oh, yeah, we don't just do books.
Occasionally, we do films.
That's cool. Yeah, I've enjoyed listening to some of your back catalog. So.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, well, so not talking about the podcast, why don't you guys talk a bit about your kind of personal background as science fiction fans?
Okay, Cece, you want to go first?
Sure. So I don't think I realized that I was a science fiction fan until later in life.
Where were you when you realized?
when you realized this. No, because I mean, for me, like, movies that are formative, I would say, for science fiction fans, like Star Wars and all that stuff, like, I liked them as a kid. They were not an obsession for me or anything like that. I actually found myself in the uncomfortable position where I really enjoyed the prequel movies and then got older right. And found out I wasn't supposed to. It's like, oh no, I have terrible taste. How embarrassing. But yeah, so I feel like I realized that I was actually what you would call a sci-fi fan when probably Michael Crichton was my gateway. I
gotcha.
Consumed the Andromeda Strain so quickly. And I have an interest in infectious diseases and stuff too. So like it really was just right up my alley. And that led me into more Crichton. And that was around the same time I read Ender's Game. And this kind of all happened in college. And then for me, that was kind of it. I've been reading sci-fi pretty much several books a year for ever since. And I mean, forming the podcast is definitely helped me a lot expand my sci-fi horizons. Like, you were talking about what Hugo Award winners we had read, and I was thinking that a lot of them I've read because of the podcast, because I'm like, oh, well, Hyperion's this great classic. I've got to read Hyperion for the podcast, and then it's sort of given me the opportunity to broaden a little bit. So, I'd say I'm sort of a late bloomer into sci-fi, but very fruitful.
Cool. All right, what about you, Peter?
So I hit a gateway genre, and that was fantasy, which I imagine is not that uncommon.
No, it's not.
I was really into the Inheritance cycle as a little kid. And then eventually I found the book series, and Cece and I were just talking about this the other day because I actually started rereading it, but the Artemis Fowl series.
Oh, so good.
Okay. Which is, it's one of those things where as an adult, you can't go in and read it for the first time, but if you were a kid and you read it, it's like the greatest nostalgic trip you'll have. And, it has like a big crossover between sci-fi and fantasy, but I would say like the first real sci-fi I read was going into freshman year. They had this like quote unquote recommended book reading list. And one of them was The Andromeda Strain. And I showed this list to my older brother, who was I didn't know it, but a huge Crichton fan. And, he was like, oh yes, that book you have to read. I read The Andromeda Strain and followed shortly by Sphere, Timeline, and all the rest. And that was kind of it. My sci-fi was my thing. And then, I got really into sci-fi media because in high school, a bunch of the Star Trek series went on Netflix.
Right.
And I binge watched all of them like in a couple months.
See, it's making me chuckle because Star Trek The Next Generation came out when I was in high school. So it's a generational difference. You punk kids.
We're taking it from you. It's ours now.
This is ours now.
Yes. No, it's my generation's gift to you, right?
Yeah. Thank you very
so
much.
So generous. We
it's really kind of you. But, and then in many ways, actually, with CC, though, like, one of the best parts of doing this podcast was before I would just kind of read what came across my desk, basically. Like, if someone suggested a book, I'm like, okay, I'll give that a shot. But now I've kind of tried to seek out books that are critically acclaimed because I had never read a review or like a critic review of a sci-fi book before I started doing our podcast because we're trying to find these, like, these common ground novels that a lot of people are really passionate about to kind of try to broaden our scopes, but also like broaden the what people might be interested in, kind of to go like make as many people happy that listen to the show as possible while also kind of satisfying our urge to read more.
I think too, Peter, the podcast was in a way, I think, born of what stage we were at in our sci-fi fanship. You know what I mean? Like, I think we started having these conversations about the books and their implications and what they made us think about the development of humanity and how we would grow, like, morally and societally. And that was where we were kind of like, you know, late to the party, but yeah, sci-fi really asks some good questions, huh? Maybe we should start a podcast about it, you know, where we can talk about these and maybe get other people to join in the conversation a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I think that was a big part of the inspiration.
Yeah, I agree.
Nice.
And I also want to agree that fantasy sci-fi crossovers, very formative for me too.
Okay.
That was a big part of it. I didn't really realize it until you said it, but you're right.
See, I'm not really that much of a fantasy fan. Although, if I look back at, like, in terms of gateway drug, I think actually you may be right, because I grew up reading the Lloyd Alexander Prydain Chronicles, which, if you haven't heard of those, it may be a similar thing to the Artemis Fowl things, where I read them as a kid, and I still love them. I still think they're tremendous. But I can't really have an objective view.
Right.
But, yeah, definitely get that.
But other than that, my reading tends to be mostly science fiction, in terms of genre reading. Mm-hmm. So now, talking about this particular book, and there's some tangled history on this because we went back and forth about what to cover for a while.
Yes.
Because we were trying to figure out if we wanted to do like true crossover kind of thing where you'd come on here, I'd come on there. But why Foundation's Edge? Why ultimately did we decide on that?
Well, I think there's kind of a weird answer here, because you had mentioned that kind of the Foundation series didn't really settle super well with you when you tried them before.
Yeah.
And Cece, you didn't immediately jump on board with them when we started them, when we did the first two.
Yeah, I gotta say, I like this book a lot more than the other Foundation books we've read.
Yeah. That's what I really like about this book, because Seth, we talked about it a little bit before we start recording, but like, this book tells much more of a story as opposed to just kind of jumping around and covering a societal thing.
Right.
Which is one of the reasons why I really enjoyed this book. It changed from like the early books where they're talking about just the Foundation as a whole, and there were characters, but they weren't the focus, to, you know, focusing on this freshman counselor who's on his journey, which I thought was really interesting and also is really accessible to more people. Like, the first Foundation book isn't really enjoyable to someone who isn't already kind of invested in the universe. But when you go to this book, it grabs your attention much better, I feel.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that. Well, if you wanted to give kind of an elevator pitch for this book, how would you do that?
Cece, you want to take this one?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's I think it's hard to do an elevator pitch for it because it's like the fourth book in a series.
Right. Yeah.
So I guess if you're not familiar with Foundation, it tells the story of humanity tens of thousands of years down the line, where we've grown to this galactic society. And in this universe, humans are alone in the galaxy, but we've been spread out for so long that there's all these different cultures and different like microcosms of power, because there once was a galactic empire that has now collapsed, and we're sort of in this in-between.
Right.
Because there's a, I guess, intellectual theory, sort of almost a religion, that is supposed to map out the period of time from the collapse of the First Galactic Empire to the rise of the Second Galactic Empire. And so all of the stories in the Foundation series, at least all of the stories that I've read, take place in that in-between. Like, the Galactic Empire has fallen, and we're working towards the development of the Second Galactic Empire, and what that looks like for society, how things are changing without a central power, and as we're climbing to a new central power.
Nice. I like it. Yeah, and I mean, this one is kind of unique in the history of stuff that I've done on the podcast, because I haven't done a lot of stuff that has definitely built on other books. But being the fourth book in a series, and it does kind of assume, maybe you've read the other ones before here, because I'm not sure, and maybe you guys disagree with me, but I'm not sure how much someone would enjoy this coming to it without having read any other Asimov.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, it's hard because I'm like you, Seth, where I didn't really like the books much the first time I read the original Foundation books, just because world building is really important to me, but equally important is characters. And it was really hard to be invested, even though it was an interesting world, because there weren't like any characters who I could really follow and care about and root for long term anyway. So it's hard because it's hard to get into the original trilogy, but then if you don't have that as a background, it can be equally hard to get into this book. I would say that this book would probably be easier to get into just because it's got more of a story. And if you like read a synopsis of the Foundation trilogy, I feel like you can at least sort of understand where this book is going. I mean, there's definitely callbacks to events of the original trilogy, but I honestly think that you could come into it at that stage and enjoy it.
Yeah, I was actually just thinking that was I bet if you read the Wikipedia synopsis of the first trilogy, or maybe of each individual, you know, the three entries in that trilogy, then you might be able to come to this and go, okay, it's talking about the mule. I remember reading about the mule, you know.
Right.
Usually, you know, I go over like who you think would like this novel or who would you recommend it to. But, and if we're going to do that, I do want to say kind of other than people who have read other Foundation novels. I don't know if you have you guys read anything else that you think, you know, or maybe even movies or television that you think, okay, if people are a fan of this, maybe they'll enjoy Foundation.
Yeah.
The Foundation's
Edge. Actually, I feel like, because you said I did another book recently, which we were both kind of like a little bit put off by, but I think later on, I kind of have grown to look back at fondly, which was The Forever War.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like people that kind of were really interested in the narrative theme. I would say the narrative style of The Forever War could probably slot pretty easily into the Foundation series. But I think that might be mostly because kind of like the language is similar, the tempo of the books are similar, because they're both, like, neither of them are exactly new books. So I think that might be a big part of the reason why I feel that way.
Yeah, I think that if you are interested in sci-fi sort of almost strictly on the world building level, the Foundation books should be really interesting to you. And you're not going to find aliens, so you won't have that aspect of it. And there's not, their tech is not that well fleshed out. So like, if you're just sort of interested in the human experience of spreading out through the galaxy and interacting and what that's going to mean for society, then the Foundation books, I think, are a good fit for that.
Agreed.
It just depends on what you're looking for.
Right. Well, so by way of overall thoughts, I mean, Cece, you hinted at the kind of the same thing that you and I may have similar thoughts here, where I was pretty tepid on Foundation at first. And it's only in the last few months, actually kind of in the lead up to doing this, that I went back and I did do an episode on The Mule, which is the, I think, the second half of Foundation and Empire. I listened to Second Foundation on audio, and, you know, I enjoyed them, but like to, you know, 3-star kind of level, where with this one, I really, really enjoyed it. And I think maybe it's a switch from the way they're published, kind of the publication history, because when you look at the original Foundation trilogy, it tends to be novellas that were published separately and then packaged into books. And so, like you said, Cece, it's, you don't follow one character through the whole thing. It's, you follow this character for 70 pages, you know, and now we're jumping 150 years and we're talking about some other characters, where in this one, it's a much tighter, simple plot and subplot kind of thing. It's really more like, you know, plot A and plot B. It's not even that one's a subplot of the other. And so I think maybe the fact that this is just more of a standard novel, it really worked a lot better for me.
Yes, yes, I would agree with that. I think that it was really well interwoven, the two stories, and there were a lot of really good parallels to be drawn. And I mean, getting to know the characters more, found them interesting, and I think that gave a lot to the book and made it easier for me to get into the universe and enjoy it.
What about you, Peter? What are your kind of overall thoughts on Foundation's Edge?
I differ from the two of you in that I've thoroughly enjoyed every single Foundation book as I've read it.
Okay.
I don't know what it is about them, but I really see one of the first reasons why, like CC mentioned, when we did Sci-Fi Sidebar was because we wanted to kind of look at sci-fi as this thing that asks questions. And I thought the Foundation series does that really well. It imagines humanity in, I'm not going to say it's unique, but I think the exact approach they took to it, it struck me as a little different or almost as pretty original, which I guess was
right.
Not as noteworthy in the 70s. But that, like, the idea that humanity has gone so far past the modern day, it has forgotten where Earth is, and that kind of grabbed me immediately, as because I think about that kind of a lot, not related to science fiction, but wondering where humanity is going and what's going to happen to our society. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons why I really enjoyed this series, and I kind of got my fill of all the society talking in the first couple of books. Now I was ready for just a regular old novel with second Foundation or Foundation's Edge.
Came in just time.
That's cool. No, and I totally agree that, like, the setup for Foundation is fantastic. And like, the first couple chapters, I really, really enjoyed. And then it mm-hmm. started to just kind of get to where it's like, okay, it's going to go through this episode and that kind of thing. But mm-hmm. Right. On the other hand, Cece and I are the ones out on an island here. Like, I think most of the opinion is, yeah, the Foundation series is fantastic. So the fact that we're a little tepid on it, yeah, that's okay.
Opinions vary. I feel like part of kind of the two of yours' opinion of the first couple of books, how, like, they're very much – they're episodic is yeah. – I mean, I correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't that how it was published? Like, it was a series of short yes. stories that were then tied together later into a novel.
Right.
So I think maybe you might not have felt so much that way if I handed you a short story and in another month handed you the next short story in the series.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's probably true. I honestly think that if – you could almost think of it as like a thought experiment, like Asimov set up this world just to sort of see what could happen. And every now and again, you get a new story from that world that shows you sort of a new perspective and a new stage of the history. Yeah. And I feel like that would have been a more interesting way to experience it. But then we were just kind of crushing it because, like, you have a week to read it and then you have to do a podcast on it. Like, maybe you don't get to enjoy it as much. I don't know how much that played into it, but.
Well, I think it's interesting too, that the fact is, here he sets up in this first book, there's going to be 1,000 years until you set up the new empire. And then he wrote a trilogy and didn't get to the 1,000 years. and then let it lie there for 30 years, I think, something like that. More than 20.
It was definitely a while.
Yeah. And then finally came back to it. So that's fascinating to me that he scoped out that whole thing and then didn't actually write all the way to it.
Because that trilogy yes. were some of his kind of more... Because some of his first very noteworthy books.
Yeah.
And then he went on and did kind of several other series that are pretty much as acclaimed and then said, oh, I kind of forgot about a Foundation, huh? And came out to revisit right. it.
Right. And I do think it's interesting too, that he starts here, and maybe he started in some of the other books as well, to start to tie together his works. Mm-hmm. Because in this one, and it's not a major spoiler, he begins to bring in the robot stories.
Right.
Yes.
Which is cool.
I was very surprised.
I think maybe we should just go ahead and get to spoilers.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm up for
it. Yeah, that way we can talk about whatever we want to. So
that's good. We're pretty much all spoilers on our podcast. Perfect. Yeah. Ready to speak freely.
How much of Asimov's other stuff have you guys read?
Nothing. I've read nothing.
Okay. I think at this point I've read every Foundation book written by Asimov.
Okay.
Because later on in the series, either there was, like, co-authors or just mm-hmm. another author totally took over. I've read a couple of those, too, but I've definitely read every Foundation book that Asimov wrote. Okay. I read a little bit of his – I can't remember the name of the series, but, like, his the robot series. I cannot remember his name right now.
Elijah Bailey?
Yeah, I think – yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Read a little bit of those, and I've read kind of a short story by him here or there because I –
okay.
I read Foundation series in high school because I was like, Asimov is this pillar of sci-fi. I should read him. And so I just started reading Asimov. And I kind of ran out of steam after I decided to take the Foundation series in like a month. But
I guess you would.
Yeah, exactly. You lose a lot of...
Yeah.
You're like, well, I've experienced it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I've done Asimov.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I have read iRobot a number of times. It's a collection of his robot fiction. And I've read a couple other of his collections, because there's like The Complete Robot and there's Bicentennial Man and other stories. There's a mm-hmm. bunch of robot collections that tend to cross over a little bit. And I think I read The Caves of Steel, which is the first of the Elijah Bailey ones. And now that I've read Foundation's Edge, I'm like, okay, I want to go back and reread The Caves of Steel and read whatever they are, The Naked Sun and The Robots of Dawn. And I think that's where you start to get into some of the background to this one, which is fascinating.
Yeah, there was more sort of robot mythology than I had realized. And like I said, I've never read any other Asimov books, but I've seen the movie iRobot.
That does not count. Not related.
No,
I liked it.
I am a defender of that movie. I really enjoy it, but it was never never ever an adaptation of iRobot. And if you want to hear more about that, you can listen to my other podcast, Take Me to Your Reader. We did an episode on iRobot. Actually, we did two episodes on iRobot, because there's an even older story called iRobot, and we did that one as well. But
is it literally not affiliated? I always thought it was an extremely loose adaptation.
No, it's really not affiliated. The script, the screenplay that they actually adapted for that movie was completely separate. It was just a robot mystery, and then they got the rights to this to the book. So they got the rights to use the name. So they just kind of slapped on some Asimovian stuff and released it.
Right.
So it's
the laws of robotics. And
it's
all
an interesting history of the whole. Is this adapted? Is it not? And kind of the lines between, should you even call that iRobot? And, most people would say, no, you shouldn't. But mm-hmm. yeah.
Yes, I imagine, especially fans of the book. And I've always known that, well, as long as I've known that there was a book called iRobot, uh-huh. I knew that it was not very much like the movie at mm-hmm. all. But I've definitely been wanting to read it for a long time. But it was very surprising to me when they start getting into the idea of the Eternals.
Yes.
And their sort of oversight of humanity, mm-hmm. that I thought was a really interesting new perspective on it, because as far as my extremely limited experience with Asimov robots goes, it was just sort of like the rules of robotics, and I had never sort of made that mental leap to think how far that could go. Because obviously the idea of robots sort of dominating humanity, quote, for our own good,
right,
is as old as science fiction, right?
It's cliche. It's
a story told over and over again. But the idea of sort of the benevolence of that mm-hmm. from because of the rules of robotic I thought it was a really interesting way to take it.
Yeah, it's if you ever get to reading iRobot, the very last story in iRobot is called The Evitable Conflict. And it kind of involves the fact that there are these positronic intelligences that kind of control the world economy. And they're starting to notice human intervention is slowly being removed from all this stuff because the robots have kind of extended the law of robot. Let's see, what is it? The first law, protect the existence of a human, right? Or I can't even remember.
I think it's protect to human. And then it's like, or no, it's do no harm to humans, like protect humans, and then it's obey humans unless it conflicts with the other two.
Yes, must not allow harm to come to a human. And they kind of extend that to must not allow harm to come to humanity. And so that's where you start getting into, I think, some of the background of those whole eternal things. But I'm not sure, because I haven't read enough of that series. But reading this one made me want to go back and read those. So if there's anybody out there listening, you can kind of give us a hint on Twitter or something. Where does the whole Eternals thing come from? But yes, it kind that. Of, it starts to bring out the, what they call the zeroth law. And that's robots shall not allow harm to come to humanity. So it's kind of a level of abstraction even above that.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's very
interesting. I also thought it was very interesting that they were like, it's through inaction. Like they like, we can't just like exist and not, and let humanity be hurt.
Right.
Which is very cool to me.
Well, so talking in spoiler talk, anything you guys want to talk about, anything about the plot, anything about themes or characters, you know, just throw it out there and we'll do this for half hour and shut it down.
So for me, probably the thing that I was most uncomfortable with this book was the whole relationship between Novi and Gendibal. And it was kind of like rubbing me the wrong way, and it felt really paternalistic and dated. And so when it when he found out that Novi was actually from Gaia, yeah, and like kind of an agent in this whole thing, I was like, yes, Novi, you have power here. Yep. It was very exciting to me that she was not just like the simpleton who sat around.
Yeah, no, and she played him. She and, totally like, played
worshipped Gendibal.
Yeah.
Because, like, man, I was getting so tired of her calling him master. And just being so worshipful. And even Gendibal's like, I should not be enjoying this as much as I am. Right. But yeah, it was really great seeing her come out like as a player, and it was totally unexpected for me, at least. Mm-hmm. Very effective.
Well,
twist.
See, yeah, it's funny because like you run into that a lot in a lot of these older books where it's completely, yes, one side. And while sci-fi oftentimes is like kind of accepting where society's going more than other genres or in other forms of media, right, mm-hmm, it still has certain levels of like the at the time it was, you know, women were kind of almost secondary. That was the mindset. Mm-hmm. And so, right, meanwhile, I had the same reaction. It was totally, I was like, just dismissing, going, okay, I mean, that's not cool, but like, I guess it's an older book. Like, I get, yeah, you know, I filter it out and try to pay attention, right, to the content. But you're right, that was great when she just turned on him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually kind of wonder, because when you look at the original Foundation trilogy, you definitely get some of that,
oh,
stuff.
Yeah.
It's 50s, yes, level understanding of sexual politics, where here this, mm-hmm, is in the, you know, the mid 80s or the early 80s, I guess. And I think it's fascinating that you had that character who turns out to be pulling the strings all along, you know, mm-hmm, and then you have the mayor, whatever her name was, from the second Foundation.
Right? Harla Brano. Oh,
yes.
Harla Brano, that's right. And actually, she's from the Foundation, not from the second Foundation. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah, she's from the Foundation. She's the mayor of the Foundation.
Yeah, and she's kind of the most powerful person in the universe, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes, I call it vintage woke.
Oh, you... She's used this
comes up a lot. This is a term we use a lot of times with,
right,
old sci-fi, where, like, they're trying really hard to be progressive, and you see it, and you're like, I see you there, Asimov. Good work.
Yeah, way to go. But, one, like, token character.
But it's still, like, progressive from the 80s.
Right.
So it's like, good job, you have some leading ladies, mm-hmm, who are pretty hardcore, but also some stuff that's maybe wouldn't fly on shelves today, but we get it. It's from the 80s.
Yep.
You did your best for the time. It was probably very progressive at the time.
Right. Well, that's like, if you go back and look at the original pilot for Star Trek, called The Cage, mm-hmm, I think, which is the one with Captain Pike way, way back in the day. At some point, like, his first officer is a woman, but... And so that seems really progressive for the mid 60s, right?
Yeah. Right.
But then he makes some comment about, I just can't get used to seeing a woman on the bridge. And you're like, okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So.
You tried.
Yeah.
You tried Star Trek.
I tried and failed. But. So maybe we should say that there's two main plots going here, mm-hmm, right? Where you have, by the nature of it, you have the first Foundation and the second Foundation, and they're kind of adversarial at this point, which is fascinating, because, yes, the Foundation is supposed to be the thing that causes the new empire to emerge.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And yet here it is looking like it's going to be civil war between the two Foundations.
Yes. And I guess, like most things in this universe, that's supposed to be a part of Seldon's plan. Like,
right,
but it's hard to tell, right? Because he obviously wanted the second Foundation to be a secret from the first.
Yeah.
But it's almost through their rivalry with each other. It's almost like we got to the moon because we wanted to piss off the Soviets. Yes. It's like a similar sort of thing. They're competing with each other, so they're both working so hard to progress to make sure that they're the most powerful people in the galaxy, and they're the ones that are going to be pulling the strings down the road, where you have to wonder if they were on the same team, would they be as effective?
I mean, right, that's true, but I also feel like the reason why they kind of knew each other existed, well, why the first Foundation knew the second Foundation existed was because of the mule. And Seldon's whole psychohistory is it can't describe the actions of an individual, only a large enough group where like statistical analysis is applicable. So I don't think it can be part of the Seldon plan that they knew about each other and they were competing. Because his plan was always for the first Foundation, well, as far as we know, his plan was for the first Foundation to master physical power and for the second Foundation to master mental power, and they become this, it seems like almost this ruling faction over the first Foundation, potentially without the first Foundation even knowing about it.
Yeah, but it's like nuclear proliferation, right? Where you have two sides amassing weapons of different kinds.
Mm-hmm.
And so eventually is that balance of power going to hold, or are they going to clash? And that's where then you get in the Gaians, etc., or Gaia, or is it
the, yeah, the, yeah, those people are Gaia. Like, I think the mentality is Gaia. The individuals that exist within it are Gaia.
Right. Yeah, and they're kind of like, okay, if we let this go much longer, then the Foundation will come up with a better mentalic shield, and that'll be a problem because they'll be able to then take over the second Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so it's like they're like, okay, we have to precipitate the conflict now before either of them is able to win it outright.
Right.
I think too, Peter, the point about the mule, like, having been the reason that the two Foundations found out about each other is really important, because I think it's hard with the Seldon plan to have stakes, because you know that everything's always going to turn out okay. And so when you have people like the Gaians or the mule who are, like, coming in, then finally you feel like maybe the plan is in peril. Mm-hmm. And that's where the actual interesting conflict comes in. And so that's, I think, probably part of what made this book so much more interesting to me, is that you're not certain that things are going to work out. And like you said, Seth, like, the Gaians are the ones who are sitting there going, this thing's about to fall apart because this whole thing happened between the two Foundations. And now they know about each other, which was never supposed to happen. And somebody's got to do something. So we're going to do something about it. But you got to wonder how far off the tracks we are now. I don't know, because I haven't read the rest of the books.
Right.
It makes me want to read them, though.
Well, yeah, because there's the question. I can't remember actually who it was that said it. Was it what is the guy's name? Gendibal? Was he the one who said the Seldon plan isn't working? Like it's meaningless?
I think they both did. I think that was one of the common themes. They both basically went to their boss and said, the plan's broken.
Yeah. Well, that was why Trevise got sent away, because he was so vocally against the Seldon plan still being a thing.
Yeah, because they're kind of noticing somebody is tweaking it. Somebody is moving it in different directions. I did think it was fascinating, the whole idea of being able to view the plan graphically.
Yes, that was very cool.
Yes.
Yeah. So I know that there's an adaptation, a forthcoming adaptation for, I can't remember which, if it's Amazon or some other place. I'm interested to see if they're going to have some of that kind of graphical analysis of it in there.
Huh.
I'm curious how that'll look.
I would think that would be a pretty important aspect of doing an adaptation of these books,
because
I remember hearing about that and thinking, that's a challenge. Like, just as it's hard to be interested in the first couple books if you're like Seth and I, I think that it could be really hard to sell that as a TV show. But then again, we are more into the sort of anthology TV shows these
days. We also talked about how it's meant to be consumed as episodes or like short stories, so that might lend itself to a TV series.
Yeah. I do think that the adaptation kind of being structured as an anthology could work really well, because you could have, you know, four or five episodes dealing with a plot point and then you move on. The only challenge then is, do you have characters that you're going to follow for the whole series? Because you can't really do that if you're going to have a Salver Hardin and all the other heads of the first Foundation
were.
Maybe they'll have Harry Seldon come in and be like a narrator.
Probably.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that's where your point comes in too, Seth, about graphically representing the plan. Like, I think that you need to really tangibly tie it all together in order to hold people's interest over a series. So
hey, you guys just kind of pictured a really complicated flowchart, right? Okay.
Yes.
Somehow I pictured it vertically, though.
What? Oh, like going, I see that. Okay.
Like looking at a river from above, but.
Oh. That's interesting.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
For me, it was like three-dimensional and digital was how I pictured it in my head. Like,
I thought he was projecting like at his wall. That's right. I just pictured like him spinning in a room, like with the projection on the wall.
Huh. Oh, cool.
I don't know. I didn't think
you mean like an old film projector, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, hey, they're using microfilms. I didn't think they could Asimov was going to figure out hologram ideas yet.
Yeah.
Another thing I love about vintage sci-fi.
Microfilm. It's the most efficient way to store memory. Don't even worry about it.
It is. It's been like 50,000 years.
Well, you guys are fans of Crichton, I know. And
yes.
there's some laughable technobabble in those as well.
Definitely.
They're talking about, hey, I've got a computer here. It's got 640K of memory.
Like, so you have an ongoing joke, especially Crichton's very, very guilty of this. But anytime someone wants to make something sound like extra sci-fi, they just add quantum. It's like anything can be quantum, man.
Yep.
If you can't explain it, just use quantum, and it's fine. No one's going to question you.
Exactly. Yeah. On Take Me to Your Reader, we did an episode on timeline, and we called it Quantum Physics Means Never Having to Say You're Sorry.
That's very good.
That should be a t-shirt, honestly.
Yeah. I'd buy that t-shirt.
If you make that a t-shirt, I'll buy it.
What did you think of... I mean, let's talk about Gaia and the Gaians and all that. What did you guys make of that, or do you have any thoughts about it?
It kind of skewed me out.
Yeah.
Like, I could acknowledge kind of intellectually that, like, it seems like a really nice way to live. You know, you don't really have to worry about everything.
Mm-hmm.
Things are getting taken care of. You're part of this greater community. In that way, it's very beautiful. In another way, I'm a relatively independent person.
Right.
Like, I don't like to define myself by the people around me.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of – I really didn't like the fact that they were all tied together on a very, very deep level.
Mm-hmm.
I also don't like the idea that I have to apologize to a wall if I, like, run into it. not a fan of that.
Yes, you know, Peter, yes.
To be fair, that wall should be apologizing to you, too, right?
It's a mutual, yeah.
Yes, it goes both ways. But
I did really like the idea, though, that they were like, yeah, everything has memory. And so I really like the analogy that the rocks can hold, like, store huge amounts of data, but it's like cold storage and we have to go get it and it takes a while.
Right.
I thought that was a very clever way to do that.
Uh-huh. That's the original solid state drive.
Oh, it was solid.
Yeah.
Yes. No, Peter, I agree with you. I believe it, because I think it seems like it, maybe the hive mind went a little too far. Like, I could get it down to the plants, but then when we start talking about inanimate objects, like, literally artificial inanimate objects, I'm like, okay, like, I don't know if I can fully buy into this. But you gotta acknowledge that if you're choosing between different fates of the universe, as Trevise had to, it is the most beneficial to the most people, I think, to go down that road. Because, I mean, how many problems in the world could be solved if people were better at putting themselves in the shoes of other people? And honestly, lack of sort of empathy and understanding is, I would say, one of the biggest societal ills in all sorts of ways. It manifests everywhere. And, you know, frankly, if you're gonna say, well, humanity can either go to war this way or go to war that way, or we could all just sort of be part of one happy consciousness and feel like we're a part of something and everyone has their place and nobody ever goes hungry. I mean, how could you choose either of the other alternatives? I mean, even with the argument of free will, it's hard to tell really how much free will the Gaians have. It doesn't seem like there's much of it. I don't know.
Not a whole lot. And you even look at, like we would see the pleasures of eating, right? I like to eat something because it tastes good, right? The nourishment of it is sometimes a secondary factor, right? If I'm going to get some ice cream or something. Whereas the Gaians are like, well, I want to eat that because it's the thing that I need to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But how could you possibly eat something for pleasure if it means, you know, taking away extra resources from something that's a part of your own consciousness?
Yeah. I did think it was interesting that they didn't say that they didn't ever eat meat, right?
Oh,
because everything is just kind of reused and recycled, and that was just the kind of the circle of life, right?
It seems weird to me that you could be so bought into the idea that you are part of a group consciousness of the whole planet and everything on it, and you can still go, yeah, that looks tasty,
right?
And just go ahead and attribute that to the fact that that's what you need.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I really agree with you. On the other hand, like, that's a very kind of nice thing, and Trevise does this a little bit in the end of this book, and basically the next book is about this, where he acknowledges that, like, yes, this would be a great thing for people, but he wanted no part of it. Like, he would not want to be part of Gaia or Galaxia, but he thinks it would be good for humanity. So it's kind of like deciding what's better for an individual or individuals, or as opposed to what's best for humanity as a species.
Yeah.
Right. And I really related to Trevise when he was, when he basically said at the end, I chose this path because it's the only one that bought me time. Right. Like, either of these other options would have happened right away, whereas going with this option, I have time to think about it, and, like, I'm not bound to this. We don't have to establish Galaxia. So I was like, yeah, Trevise, like, I would have made the same call, given that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's good for humanity in a future generation that I'm not going to see.
Yeah, exactly.
That too. But it is, it's kind of dystopian. It has a sort of dystopian feel where it's like, okay, everyone's at peace, but at what cost?
Right.
Yeah. What, just kind of, just wanted to see what you guys, what was your preferred storyline? Trevise's or like the Second Foundation's?
Trevise, because it didn't have that weird Novi relationship.
That's fair.
Yeah, I think I would side with Trevise and Janov or Janov, whatever his name was. I work with enough people from Poland that I'm like, that's Janov. yeah, I kind of like their dynamic and the whole idea of searching for Earth. That was an interesting thing to me, and that's kind of what won it over.
Yes,
that's fair.
Yes,
I can understand that.
Yeah, what about you?
I really like the Second Foundation, and mostly because for the first three books. Second Foundation is, I mean, they a little more talk about it in the third book, but really it's there's like a chapter here, a chapter there.
Yes.
And I really liked being able to actually get into it and see the Second Foundation, because when I read books and there's something that really is piquing my interest, but they never get into it, it's so frustrating for me.
Yeah.
So you spend three books.
It's like a sweet
release. You spend three books like really wanting to know more about this mysterious Second Foundation, and then I really liked the whole storyline in there. About how, yeah, I kind of like the idea, like their mental power and the fact that they didn't just treat Harry Seldon like this, you know, prophetic figure who laid bare the secrets of the universe. They said, yeah, he was really intelligent. He was the founder of our science. However, we've been like, this has expanded way beyond him.
Yeah.
I thought that was extremely interesting too.
I definitely agree. Learning about the Second Foundation was one of my favorite things about this book. I say I prefer Trevise's story, but it's not a strong preference. Like, they're both very good stories.
That's fair.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was, I was wondering, I was actually curious if Gendebal, if we're going to find out that he wasn't as capable as he really thought he was. because he talked a good game for a lot of this book, and I'm like, yeah, but are you going to actually be able to hold off everyone from Gaia? Are you sure?
Like, everyone?
About that? You know? Well, even when I mean, I did enjoy the standoff between Gendebal and Mayor Brano, where he's like, okay, yeah, there is a shield there. I found the shield, but I can get through it, and I can squish your puny little brains.
It was very good.
That was pretty cool, because you got a little bit of an idea kind of how far the Second Foundation had evolved.
Right.
The past humanity was, but you never really got a concrete, well, I guess this is concrete as we're going to get in this series anyway. You never got really concrete estimate of like, all right, well, really, where are they? And apparently it's pretty far. So that was a nice touch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I do agree, though, it would have been more interesting if you had, I guess, more limitations, because it didn't really seem like there was many limitations.
Weirdly godlike power.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's also part of why I appreciated Novi's like turn on him so much, and the fact that in the end Gaia was the one pulling the strings, because it's he does have this sort of, like you said, Peter, weirdly godlike, seemingly limitless mental power, and it's good to see that it's not totally on top of the pile. There's greater power out there in the universe.
To be fair, it took an entire planet. So I mean,
did it though? he wasn't as much more powerful than Novi than he thought, right? Was powerful enough to be brought before the entire Speaker's Council and fool them into thinking she was just this simple creature.
Well, I kind of thought the whole idea was that Gaia had almost removed itself from her and left this personality behind. And then, like, it was a base of her Gaian personality, I guess. Yeah. But when she came back within, like, the fold of Gaia, I think that was the kind of the impression I took from it, that...
Huh.
Yeah, it was like an awakening.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, a sleeping consciousness was awoken and she became this kind of BA character.
Right. That's reminding me of, it's getting close to Easter time here. And so it's reminding me of, like, in Christian theology, the idea of Jesus laying down his divine prerogatives until after his resurrection. But sorry.
So what you're saying is
that is interesting.
Serenovi is a Christ figure.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
All right. Fantastic.
On the record.
I agree with that. It's a very good thought.
This is my thesis.
I wouldn't have thought of that.
No, it's interesting though. I like it.
So one of the touches I really like, because you talked a little bit about, I mean, we've grown up, but like the idea that kind of Earth's been lost and Pelerat's trying to find it. I thought it was a nice touch when they were talking about like the various clues he's kind of scrooged together from various like ancient texts. Yes. And because like there's really the three things that came out, right? It was the Earth had a 24-hour day, a 365-day orbit, and a large satellite.
Large moon, yeah.
And she was like, oh, and it had, oh, and then on fourth, it was Saturn. They were like, it had a massive gas giant with a huge ring system. And Tree's like, that's ridiculous. There are no planets like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such like a, first of all, it was funny because it was kind of interesting that Asimov was like, yeah, let's just go ahead and make this unique. Yeah. Like humanity is spread across this entire galaxy and like there is nothing else like Earth. Obviously it's more of a literary tool than anything else that Asimov's belief in it, but it was interesting that no other planets had a 24-hour day, 36-hour day, year, and all that, the rest.
Right.
But it was cool because that's kind of, we've talked a lot about the societal view from the Foundation series. And it's true, I can very easily imagine that's true, that moving forward, if humanity establishes an intergalactic civilization, right, or interstellar civilization, they're going to need some sort of general set of time, like Greenwich Mean Time on Earth. And right. So it would make sense for them to keep the 24-hour day, 365-day year, at least for kind of interstellar like business. Like maybe each planet will have their local time and their local calendar, but like as far as the society as a whole, all sticks to Earth's original.
Right.
Right.
So I think it's very likely that that kind of thing would permeate and carry on through society where, like, and so far in the future where Earth has been lost.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with that, especially because I think once you've set a standard, it's really, really, really hard to change it. So it's sort of believable that over millennia, it would be like, nope, sorry, this is how business is conducted. Like, we can't change it at all. Well, one thing that I found unrealistic was when Truvies was talking to Pelerat about language. And Pelerat's like, yeah, there were like 6 or 7 different languages on Earth, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
And Trivius is like, that's ridiculous.
There's no way that would function.
Right.
The idea that like everyone in this galaxy understands each other pretty much perfectly as though they were Australians, South Africans, English, and Americans talking to each other.
It
blows my mind. I can't believe that, honestly.
Yeah. Well, if they have some kind of faster than light communication, then it makes a certain amount of sense. But
I guess.
Yeah, it really all depends on how much contact there is between planets.
Yeah.
Right.
But
and maybe there wasn't enough time without the Galactic Empire before the First Foundation sort of spread its tendrils out for there to really fall apart communications. Because I guess I believe it under the guise of an empire, that everyone in the empire would have a common language that they could all speak to each other.
Uh-huh.
But once that sort of fell apart and you see like all the different pocket kingdoms popping up in the earlier Foundation books, I guess given enough time, they would definitely diverge linguistically, but maybe it just wasn't enough time. And so everyone kept the same language, especially if it was something that it's the only language anyone's spoken for thousands and thousands of years, then maybe it's a little more believable.
Even so, everything we know about the way language develops now, it's a pretty big intellectual leap. Because if you go back 500 years from now, you know, English just barely exists.
Yeah. Yeah, no, Old English is completely indecipherable unless you're really paying attention.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's totally true.
Well, so, and in this book, in Foundation's Edge, it got me to thinking about history and, like, the difference between in schools, what we learn about like U.S. history, which is this small little, you know, it's a couple hundred years, and versus world history, which is several thousand years, right? And we learn little bits about that, but I still have a hard time believing that everybody would forget about Earth.
Like
that wouldn't be mandatory teaching, even from a mythological standpoint.
Right.
Well, I think, you know, in 1,000 years, if Earth was destroyed, basically, I mean, that's
right.
What a lot of these people are kind of believing. The legend is that Earth was destroyed. And we right. go, I think, because the Empire was standing for 10,000 years, right?
I thought it was like 30,000 years.
So I think at that point, and we'll assume that humanity was spreading out for a while beforehand for some polity to gain enough power to be able to conquer the rest of the species. I think it's pretty likely that if Earth was destroyed relatively early on, which we kind of get a vibe from that in the, again, in the later books, which, by the way, I highly encourage both of you to read if you enjoyed this one a lot more than the previous ones. But it's, you see, like, we learn a lot more about the history of Earth and kind of how the colonization went throughout the galaxy. And it was very kind of, it was very separated and in basically two bursts. So if one went out and then the other went out and then Earth died off, I can see it very quickly becoming, okay, we're a new colony or we're a young world. We have to focus on making sure this world can keep going. And well, in an,
yes.
Today, in the world of, you know, digital storage and backup upon backup upon backup, it's extremely unlikely that colony of knowledge would be lost. If you look at Asimov's time, where they're still using microfilm as a form of storage, it's much easier to believe that, like, oh, yeah, the library store the data just degraded and no one thought to copy it onto a new one before it did.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good point.
I kind of think about it, again, in the things that were surprising to me. When Pellerat and Treves were speaking, Treves, I think, had a hard time recognizing or like wouldn't have assumed that humans hadn't always been everywhere. So it's funny to think about. I don't know that they talk about the origin of species at all, both in a Darwin sense, just then in a general sense. Like, the universe to them has always been full of humans and full of Earth flora and fauna. Mm-hmm. Which they wouldn't even recognize as Earth flora and fauna. And that's just how it is. And like the only way I can sort of reconcile that is by thinking about how, you know, obviously humanity came from somewhere on Earth. Like we, you know, came out of Africa and evolved and all of that stuff. But you never think about it that way. And so you're just like, as a kid especially, humans have always been all over the planet, right? Like, that's how you think about it. You're like, people have always been on all of the continents, except Antarctica, maybe. And you don't really question it.
Yeah, but, I mean, anthropology is important to a lot of kind of the stories of that cultures tell themselves about themselves. So, like, if you go to, the, like, the Polynesian islands, right, they'll each have their story of how, you know, basically creation started with them, right? That's always the way it is, right?
Right.
The story of us is that something created everything and it started with us. We were the first ones. And you have that. You look all over the earth and tons of cultures want to look back to that creation event kind of thing. And it's fascinating here that they don't seem to do that anymore.
That's true. They've just grown past that interest.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
No, people have always existed. Just, you know, spontaneous generation, right?
Right, despite the fact that during the first book, they found a planet. Like, in that very same book, they find a planet that has no life on it, and they bring life to it. And yet, a couple hundred years later, Treves is thinking, oh, I guess it makes sense that we all came from one place. I just never thought about it before.
Right. Maybe they just have different priorities.
Yes. Well, clearly. They're all about the physics. They don't care about biology. Apparently.
Even when they try to care about biology, like in the third book, they still care about the physics because they're just like reading electric signals. They're not actually doing anything else. They're basically taking like a print of the mind and reading all the electric signals instead of doing anything real with it. Mm-hmm.
Let's put this in physics terms.
Yeah, exactly.
So we can understand it.
Which is funny because I'm trying to think of a good blanket term for them, but I feel like the other sciences, kind of other than basically physics and chemistry, have really had a surge in popularity, yes, but also, like, I don't know, I don't want to see general respect. I just want to see general, like, noteworthiness. Like, you know, I feel like in the 20s, like psychology is a great example. Psychology is, like, the definition's, like, the science of kind of the the thought structure of human. I don't ever remember the definition. My psychology 0-10 class has really stuck with me. And
aren't you in that class right now?
I am. I went on Monday. But anyway,
doing really so well.
The when this book was written, like, physics, chemistry, biology, kind of, but mostly physics and chemistry were like, if you were a renowned scientist, you were probably a physicist or a chemist.
Yes.
And I feel true. Like much more recently, you know, biology, genetics, like people are studying that kind of thing, especially infectious diseases, have been like huge jumping forward into the forefront of science, and all of a sudden people are paying a lot more attention to it. But like, you know, in the 60s or like in the 40s, if you wanted to be an awesome scientist, you were a physicist working on like the nuclear field or something.
That's true. And there's even, there's a whole slightly offensive segment at the beginning of the Andromeda Strain where Michael Crichton calls biology, and I quote, the retarded child. That was right. Slow and behind everything else. His words, not mine. But like, he literally makes a point of saying, oh yeah, biology is like, it's behind, it's slow. But now it's catching up. Now. And then he continues to write a whole book about how biology is cool.
Right.
You make a good point, Peter, that I hadn't really thought about it too much, but yeah, I guess to an extent, this sort of, I don't want to call them soft sciences, but
that was my first term too.
I don't know where I'm getting it from. I don't think of them that way. Not really. And they're so interwoven.
I've definitely
nowadays.
Heard physicists refer to biology and that kind of stuff as squishy science.
Squishy. I mean, we do deal with a lot more squishy.
I'll say squishy science is, yes, you're a squishy scientist.
Oh, thanks. I feel so good. But really, I mean, once you get... I'm just saying, once you get deep into a science, it's hard to separate it from the other sciences. Like,
yes.
You can't get too deep into biology without talking about physics and chemistry, too.
That's right.
But that's probably more of a recent... That's probably more reflective of the age in which I became a scientist and the way science is taught now than anything else.
Seth, Cece and I kind of gave our answers. I guess I did. Cece gave her answer, though. What would you have chosen if you were Trevise?
Ooh, good question. I mean, I do kind of, I definitely resonate with his idea that, okay, this is the choice that I can make that doesn't have immediate effect, that just starts heading us in this direction, right? And so it gives some time to reflect and go, is this really the way we want to go? And so I think I probably would have ended up that way as well.
Okay. That makes
Peter,
sense.
Peter, ready to commit?
Yeah, I'm recording commit to the First Foundation, and I think it's because my favorite science is 100% physics. and I'm self-aware enough to acknowledge that that's probably why I'm going with it, especially after our last conversation. But
right.
Yeah, I think I would go with the First Foundation. You know, they're not perfect, but they also strike me as like as close to kind of an ideal society as we're going to get as humans in almost an unaltered state. Because the Second Foundation has their mental powers. Gaia has their, you know, hive mind going on. and the First Foundation is just like normal people who are real good at science, and they're just doing the best they can to build a society, which kind of I like.
I give you that.
My feeling is, though, that, you know, they would basically end up doing a game of galactic whack-a-mole, right? Where they conquer as much as they can, and then you know, there's an uprising over here. Okay, send your super high-tech ships and go blast them and then come back, you know?
Yeah.
And, yeah.
That's not ideal. No, it's not great.
Yeah, there was no perfect answer. Although Gaia did point out, and I appreciated this, that it was going to become kind of like a military dictatorship eventually.
Yeah.
She's like, you guys think you're this enlightened democracy, but if you're going to start having to use military force constantly, this society that you have right now, which maybe is a good thing, is going to change.
Yeah.
Which is fair. But I just think the average person kind of resonated with me.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
One of the funny things that I thought was, you know, talking about the science and the advanced ships with their gravitic drive and all that kind of stuff, was the discussion about what it smells like on a ship or on a planet.
Oh, yes. Yes. It just made me think,
these super advanced ships, do they not have good shower facilities or something?
Must be.
I don't know.
I thought it was very funny that Pelerat goes on his first foreign planet, and the first thing is, his first reaction is, man, that stinks.
Yeah, it's funky here.
And Therese is like, yeah, it is, isn't it?
Yeah, really soak it in.
I thought it was funny too. Then when Bliss tells them, by the way, it was pretty funky in your ship. But I didn't want to say anything about it because I was being polite. But now we're on my planet, and you have to be polite.
It was kind of like such an unnecessary piece of color for the book, and I loved it. Yeah. I appreciated it very much.
It was a very
I like that.
It was a very like it was a moment of levity in a book series, which is kind of customarily very serious and just it's here to tell the story with no frills.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I did appreciate that a great deal.
It's a nice little treat.
There was kind of, by way of talking about any cringy stuff in here, when they introduced Bliss, there was quite a bit of about what she, about her shape and what her thighs looked like and her backside. And
yes. It was very really graphic.
Very uncomfortable.
Yeah. And then Trevise pretty much just was like, this girl will keep saying things and I'm not going to listen to what this girl is saying.
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely. Vintage woke.
Think that one was just vintage, CC.
That one was just vintage.
It wasn't exactly vintage woke. You know, it's weird. CC, we had this experience in Hyperion where, like, all of a sudden this book just took a really weird turn. Like, when it was, when, like you mentioned, when they were doing, like, the very too in-depth description of Bliss. Like, I mean, I actually don't remember from reading your list, but you did cover Hyperion, right?
Yeah. It was my early episodes.
Yeah, okay. I think I did listen to that one, but you remember? Do you remember? I'm sure you remember that chapter we're talking about with the colonel or what's his name. But anyway,
yes,
right.
It's just
where he's getting busy with the Shrike.
Yeah, it's just all of a sudden a very weirdly inappropriate thing to be slotted into this science fiction book from like the mid to late 20th century.
Yeah,
that was unexpected.
It's very surprising.
It was. I expect that from more nowadays, where people are typically less desensitized or more desensitized to that. But okay,
right.
Right. I think it's more about the tonal shift. Honestly, I don't know. That to me is what makes it so offsetting, especially with Hyperion, where that was not really a part of any of the stories. Then it was his entire story was about sex, basically.
Yes. Yeah.
And so it was just sort of a weird shift. I think this one, like you said, is more just vintage, where like. This girl shows up and she's attractive. And so then Trevise belittles her and Pellerat like turns into a total fool for her. And I mean, it's just a product of the times, I think.
But also,
but she did have agency to an extent. Like she mattered.
Yeah.
She mattered a lot actually in the end.
I was about to say that might be kind of, I'm not saying
it is vintage book.
I'm not saying Asimov was perfect in everything he wrote, but I'm saying like, he has shown a history of, trying to lull the reader into going, oh, yes, this is what I expected from women. And then all of a sudden, you know, Bliss is this, like, really cool character who matters a whole ton, is, like, designated by Guy to speak for Guy to him and all this stuff. And, but, you know, she just also happens to be extremely attractive. Like, I think that maybe that's what he was going for if we were going to try to justify it for him.
But there's also that part with, like, the 90-year-old man where he's like, hey, you're looking good, sweetheart. And she's like, yeah, I put this top on for you.
Right.
Yeah.
So it goes, it's, he tries.
Yep.
Some parts of it didn't age that well, but I think you just sort of know that that's going to happen when you read old sci-fi.
Yeah, you have to accept it. If you're going to read the classics, then sometimes things will get a little uncomfortable with your modern sensibilities.
I tell you though, I'm going to, when I tweet out this episode, I'm totally putting in hashtag vintage woke. So we're going to make that happen.
Fantastic.
I love it. It's going viral.
Nice.
One thing I do want to ask you guys is, what do you think about the kind of idea of Trevise being like, you know, having like the quote unquote perfect intuition, like as that plot device? Would you guys think that like in any way made sense, or what'd you feel about it?
I mean, he kind of hung a lantern on it though, right? Because even Trevise is asking that question.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
He's like, well, why exactly is it me?
I never got a good answer.
So are you saying we don't learn any more about that in the
Oh, no, that's the rest that's the basis series? Of the second book. Of the next book.
Right.
Okay, gotcha.
As in like a further exploration of whether or not he really does have a superior intuition and sort of, I guess, superior judgment to literally anyone else.
Yeah, the second book is basically it gives you a lot more history of really early human expansion, and it tells you why Gaia, like why Gaia discover this about Trevisan, how all that ties in. Okay. That's the most I'll say without, like, spoilers and also leaving the scope of this episode.
It sounds right. Really interesting.
And you know, Trevise, here, he's thinking of it from a human agency kind of standpoint, mm-hmm. right? Where, mm-hmm. like, here, this thing happened on my planet that got me exiled onto this crap assignment, and now you're telling me that I'm the only one who can make the decision. That doesn't even make any sense. But when you really actually spin it all back out from Gaia's perspective, they were pulling the strings all along.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I'm interested to learn more about that.
I also do think it's sort of unexpected that the person with perfect intuition and perfect judgment would come from the first foundation rather than the second foundation. Because right. the way it's sort of set up is the first foundation is the inventors, the tinkers, the doers, and the second foundation is the thinkers. And yeah. so it's funny that it wouldn't be one of the ones from the more philosophical
yeah.
intellectual leadership of the galaxy. It's from like the more, I would say down-to-earth foundation, for lack of a better term.
And you call intuition, like, your first leap without thinking, like, the first way you jump when something happens.
Right.
Then that makes sense to me. Like, the thinkers are going to try to solve the problem analytically and work their way through all the steps and try to see all the outcomes, whereas the doers sure. are just going to yeah. go, all right, yes, this, and then they'll jump.
That's a right. good point. And I think invention involves a lot of intuition.
That reminds me of when I was in college. I had a friend who was a psychology major, and he for one of his assignments, he needed to find a couple and administer a Myers-Briggs test to both of them. And so my wife and I were engaged at the time. He gave it to us, and we were looking at the things where you have to choose one word over another.
Uh-huh.
And mm-hmm. and my wife read one and said, "Impulse or decision?" Hmm. And I fell off my chair laughing, and she's like, "What? What?" And I'm like, "Just read it again. You'll get it.
You'll get the joke."
Yeah,
that's very funny.
I think I had
a similar reaction when I took the Myers-Briggs test in high school.
Yeah,
it was a very weird experience.
That's too funny.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Well, how about final thoughts?
All right, Cece.
I guess my final thoughts are: I really like it. I really like what it brought to the universe of the Foundation. I think, in a way, this is sort of what we've been building up to, is we're sort of off the track of where we would expect to be according to the Selden plan, you know, and now we're getting into some really interesting territory where you're not really sure what happens next. And whereas when I read the other Foundation books, I didn't really feel that compelled to keep reading. Mm-hmm. Now I feel compelled to keep reading.
Yeah, me
so
too.
It's a great book. I think it raises a lot of really interesting points, and I like it a lot. I recommend it.
Cool. What about you, Peter?
I feel like the first three books are the most arduous prequels I've ever read. Like, their story is interesting. Like, I mean, I've said I enjoy them, but they just keep going. And then you kind of hit this book, and it feels like this is the story Asimov wanted to write.
Right.
Like, this is where it was all leading to. He set up this great stage and had this grand universe. And I have no idea how true this is, like we've already talked about. This book was years after the first three.
Yeah.
But you get the strong impression. I don't know whether that just speaks to Asimov's talent as a writer or his forethought or just dumb luck, but that's the feeling I got from it when I got into this book and the next book, that this is like the actual story being told about the Foundation.
Right. Well, kind of once you knew that the second Foundation existed, and like you said earlier, right, we just got little nibbles of it here and there in the mm-hmm. previous trilogy. And now that we have fully formed both the first Foundation and the second Foundation, that is kind of, that's the way the story can progress.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm. yeah, so. I guess it goes without saying, but I really enjoyed this book. It's one of my favorites in the series, and definitely on my top 10 list overall in sci-fi.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's funny because coming to this one, I thought, oh, you know, how often is it that the fourth book in a series is the one that you're like, yes, that one? You know? where so many times it's like, you know, I don't know if you guys have ever read the Dune series, but like I've been advised mm-hmm. strongly, like stop after the first one because it's diminishing returns after that.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
And so
I started reading the second book and didn't get that far into it, to be honest.
Exactly what happened with me. And so here, I'm like, this is the fourth book, and yeah, I like it much better than the other ones. So, yeah, I'm really grateful that you guys, you end up picking this one. And you guys have you done an episode on Second Foundation yet?
We have not. We did the first two in the series, and then we kind of plan on doing this next two at some point relatively soon. You know, probably this half of this year. Relatively soon.
All right. I'm looking forward to that. So on that note, why don't you let people know where they can find you?
Well, you can find us on two Facebook pages. You can find us on facebook.com/sci-fi sidebar, or we're ostensibly a podcast network. Mostly the other one is just me jumping in when I have time to do an episode, and sometimes I have a friend doing it. So it's facebook.com/sci-fi sidebar or facebook.com/signifyingnothingnetwork.
Okay. Cool. Well, I'll make sure to get all the lists from you to put in the show notes. But you guys, this was a pleasure. Really want to thank you for coming on.
Seth, I had a great time.
Thank you so much for having us.
Cool.
Yes.
Well, I will definitely look forward to your episodes on Second Foundation and Foundation's Edge in the days to come. And on that episode, I'm sure we'll figure out the things that you forgot to talk about today.
There's always something
with these books.
There always is. Every time I'm editing an episode, I'm like, oh, that's right. I wanted to say that. But then it's too late. But...
Cool. Exactly.
No, so again, thank you so much. And I'm sure that we'll interact later on down the line.
Absolutely, Seth.
Definitely. Cool. Thank you so much for having us. This was a great time.
All right. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that episode. I had a great time talking to Peter and Cece. I'm probably not going to always be doing, you know, two guests at a time, but I felt like in this case it made sense to do it. So I'll put all their links in the show notes so you can go check out their stuff. And I also want to invite you to leave me a review in iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or however you download this podcast. Leave me a review. Tweet at me at Hugo's Podcast. You can like the Facebook page, facebook.com/Hugo's Podcast. And I think that's about it. So I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.